This is Seattle's Morning News. I think it's a mind game that we've all indulged in once in a while. What if you'd stuck with your original life plan? Like in my case, to become a physicist, or for some people, I don't know, airline pilot or a teacher, or in Rachel Friedman's case, a virtuoso viola player. And Rachel agonized about it enough that she decided to write a book about it, which is titled And Then We Grew Up. And you had an interesting adolescence. You went to the Interlaken Arts Camp in Michigan. Describe what that place was like.
Interlaken is a very intense and very magical place. Kids go there to study music or acting or dance or visual arts. And it was a really formative experience for me as a young musician because it was essentially boot camp for creative kids. So you learned very quickly if what you were interested in and talented at was going to be something you wanted to pursue in a professional way or not.
Yeah. And you eventually found out that you probably couldn't cut it with a professional level symphony orchestra and you wanted to become a writer. But then you decided to go back and track the careers of eight other students you went to school with. Why?
I did. I was a musician up until college and then faced a moment where I realized that not only was I not sure if I was good enough to make it, but even if I worked very, very, very hard, I was going to be giving up so much in pursuit of that goal that I wasn't going to be happy. So years later, as a freelance writer, I was struggling financially and feeling again this gap between what I thought my life would look like as a writer and what it actually did look like. And one of our former campmates has become a very well-known actor named Ben Foster. And around the time that I was grappling with these questions, I went to see a movie that I didn't realize was starring him. I had sort of wandered in on a rainy afternoon and got me thinking about what happened to all of our other friends who hadn't become wildly successful actors and were in the public eye. How had their artistic ambitions turned out?
So pick one of the students that you profiled and tell me what was their story. What happened to them?
So I'll pick Sarah, who's from a chapter called Never Quit, But Maybe Quit. She played the flute. She was very serious as a child and then actually became a professional musician. And late in her 20s, she realized she was unhappy. So she had really gotten what she set out to do. She'd gotten what she wanted and then had to make this choice to let it go because it was no longer making her happy and veered down another path. And that's not a story we tell a lot. We hear a lot about getting very far down a path, getting what you want, and then having to reevaluate at that stage and making another choice about what your life is going to look like.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked that story because the lesson there is it may be okay to quit. You're taught to persevere, to muddle through no matter how tough it is. But that's not always the best decision.
Exactly. And in reality, there are plenty of times in our life when we're better served by quitting something, by letting something go, than by persevering. And there's research that has shown that people who are able to quit at the right moment are healthier people. They have lower levels of stress hormones, lower levels of inflammation. The trick is figuring out when that moment is. And I think it's different for each one of us.
You also have this concept of the ghost ship that didn't carry us. So as the person who is clearly a success in the eyes of the world, but who knows how they actually feel about it themselves?
Right. So in the last chapter of the book, I reunite with the person at camp who really got what I thought I wanted. She's a violist, she plays in a major symphony, and it was a really important part of that journey to see that even for her, someone who got, again, exactly what she wanted, that it's complicated.
So you found the person who would have been you.
Right.
If yes. You had stayed in music.
Well, I don't even think it would have been me because she was much better than I was. Mm-hmm. And that was something, too, that was hard to face, but I think important to face because we also tell ourselves stories along those lines. As long as I had worked hard enough, had enough ambition, that's not always enough, actually.
Mm-hmm. And was she deliriously happy living the dream?
She was happy, but she has actually transitioned now into arts management. So she had this great gig with a professional symphony. She had tenure as a musician, which as an orchestral musician is hugely important, especially given how precarious it is these days with orchestras in all parts of the country. And she has now left the orchestra to go into this administrative role because that was something that she grew to be interested in.
Remember the old movie, The Turning Point? It was a movie about two ballerinas, one of whom stuck with it and ended up single and alone, and the other who left ballet and always regretted it, but ended up with a husband, children, a picket fence, and a happy family. And you can guess who the hero was in that film. So,
sure.
So I guess the bottom line is, what's the overall lesson of this for people who have those second thoughts about the biggest decision of their lives? That is, what will I be when I grow up?
If you're struggling to let go of those regrets, you should really interrogate those fantasies, because it's not as simple as thinking, if I had only gone down this path, I'd be happier. And we can't think of our lives as these a la carte choices that we make. And, you know, maybe if I had become a musician, it would have impacted all sorts of other things in my life, certain relationships I have, certain other kinds of accomplishments. When I really look at my life as a whole, would I trade it for this kind of unknown what if? Probably most of us wouldn't, but we don't know how certain choices would have rippled through the rest of our lives. So it's a really kind of futile exercise imagining that we would have been blissfully happy in any other life.
Yes. And then we grew up on Creativity, Potential, and the Imperfect Art of Adulthood by Rachel Friedman. Rachel, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Choke points. As more drivers hit the roads today after Monday's light snow day, Chris has some advice from the Washington Department of Transportation on what you can do to stay safe. I heard you on the phone with them. They felt that Monday went pretty well. Anyway.
Yeah, and you know, and I think I talked about it a lot yesterday, because first let me say, I think the state and all the local DOTs did a great job from Sunday into Monday. Because I had never seen a snow event that had dumped 6 or more inches up in the convergence zone that did not mess up the freeway. And I'd not seen that until yesterday morning. I was really surprised. The workers got ahead of that storm and did a really good job on the main roads. Now, today's been a little different. As we've been talking about, there's a little bit more widespread snow and there's a little bit more in the HOV lanes than we've seen, at least in the north end. But yeah, I asked WashDOT's deputy maintenance manager, director, that is, Chris Johnson, how they were able to pull off yesterday's great job. And he told me it was some hard work, of course, but good timing.
We started looking at the staff that we had in the south end and looked at the need we had in the north end, and we were shifting trucks and people and resources from the south Seattle area up into north Seattle, into north King County, and to help our guys out of our Everett shop as well to make sure that we got I-5 and 405 cleaned up and ready for the morning commute.
So since the storm hung up to the north and really left the south alone yesterday, the state was able to send in the cavalry. So they moved a bunch of people, which they haven't normally done. They usually just stay in your region in case everything goes bad. This time they sent a whole bunch more resources, and they were able to take care of the areas that need it. And Johnson told me that that's something that they learned from last February's big snow and ice storm, was what, you know, better communication across all the agencies to really kind of attack the areas that need it and leave the places that don't.
Just that communication and that awareness of where we have issues that are developing. That way we can respond where we're most needed.
And Johnson expects that's going to continue through the rest of the week, especially when we have the potential for hard refreezes like we've kind of seen today with the temperatures where they are. And that's why they will be focusing on keeping freeway drains clear to give any melting water that they, you know, if there was snow to push off to the side, they don't want it to refreeze. They need it to go somewhere.
It needs someplace to go. And if we've got those ice ruts, if we've got the drains that are plugged or blocked, then the runoff cannot get to those. And that just keeps the water there, and then that's potential for a refreeze.
And that's when we really could get in trouble. But the state says they're ready for that should their pre-treatment job not do the work.
If it's a roadway where we've got an ice bottom on the road, then we'll actually move in and put down a blend of sand and salt together. So we've got some mechanical friction with the sand and the chemical attack with the salt. Make sure we get that ice broken up.
And what I've been hearing from overnight is a lot of people, they've kind of moved to that that mixture with salt out there to really kind of get after the places that they need to. But it's also up to the public to handle the conditions as well. I mean, we have a responsibility to play in this as well. Drivers need to be aware of what's coming on their routes, and they have to manage their speeds and their stopping distances, because Johnson says complacency behind the wheel can be a killer.
People do tend to think, oh, it's free, it's clear over here, and you come around a corner and you hit that ice spot that you didn't anticipate. So I think people need to slow down and drive for the conditions.
And for goodness sake, stay away from trucks working to clear or treat the roads. Johnson says you should never tuck in behind a DOT truck. I see a lot of people do that and go, oh, well, it's the best it's ever going to be plowed. I'm going to slide in right behind the plow. Well, you know, you should leave several hundred feet behind those things, kind of like you're supposed to do with a police vehicle or a fire truck or an ambulance. You're supposed to leave a pretty good buffer. And you should also avoid really dumb maneuvers around these trucks. Johnson told me yesterday that a driver decided to cut off one of their maintenance trucks Sunday night, and it because he thought he was going to miss his exit. That didn't go well.
He started sliding a little bit, and they played bumper cars with one of our snow plows. You need to please, please, please give our people the room they need. Don't crowd the plows and give them the room to do their work.
Don't crowd the plows.
I know who wins that game.
Yeah, I don't think anything is going to win that. You have no chance with one of those. So it's a combination of the DOTs doing really good jobs and trying to stay ahead of this stuff. And then we've got, as I said, we've got a serious role to play in this when it comes to watching your speeds. The one thing I do notice a lot on a day like today where the GP lanes are maybe better than the HOV lanes and people who want to be going faster get up on people and start riding them. Someone who's going 40 on the freeway right now is probably freaking out a little bit anyway. And while they probably should be in the far right lane, maybe they don't feel comfortable transitioning. Don't ride up on their backside because that just makes them even more scared and can cause issues. If you're late, you're late today. I mean, your boss is going to get it. And I know those people should get over, but maybe they're a little nervous to get over, and you're like, oh, well, you know, stay off the roads if you're not comfy. Well, that's great, but sometimes people have to go places.
On some roads, people are just trying to drive in the ruts, and that makes it basically a one-lane road.
That is also, yeah, you stay where you can kind of see a little bit of pavement, and I totally get that. So just be patient with people out there, because realizing that if you get up behind somebody and they slam on their brakes, and next thing you know, you have no stopping distance, we've got an accordion tile style fender bender, and that doesn't help anybody.
Yeah. And now, bring us up to date on the legislative session and some new rules that they may be considering. Let's go to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. These are a pair of bills being proposed in Olympia.
Democratic Senator Reuven Carlisle says our world has changed.
We know that we're living in a profoundly transformational time, socially, economically, politically, in every way. And the foundation of that change is data. The value of data to us as individuals and to us as a society. It has transformed the media industry, the advertising industry, virtually every other industry in this country and around the world.
At the same time,
we live in a time when the federal government has struggled to take a stand on the weather. It has never been more important for state governments to take bold and meaningful action in the arena of consumer data privacy. And that's what this legislation does.
That's why he says his bill is so important. It would give you and I new rights over our data, including the right to access, delete, and correct our data, and opt out of even having it collected.
From targeted ads, and from the sale of our data, and from profiling. Basic core rights.
His bill applies to any company that controls or processes data of more than 100,000 people, and those that get more than half their revenue from selling data of 25,000 people or more. A separate bill from Senator Joe Wynn has new facial recognition technology regulations.
Well, largely the tenets that we wanted to focus on as we crafted this is how do we protect communities who oftentimes have been disproportionately impacted by a whole host of things, whether it's technology or otherwise. And having spent the past few months on this, I feel like we've developed a great relationship amongst many stakeholders to kind of find that path where we understand how do we hold people accountable if it's using it correctly? How do we fix that? But also how do we kind of alleviate concerns for communities as well in terms of what it should not be able to do?
Among other things, his bill sets new limits on how governments and police can use that tech. There were similar efforts last session, but lawmakers couldn't find agreement. This year, Senator Carlisle says things are shaping up different.
We have overwhelming consensus that, A, we need to move forward. We have about, I would say, 95% agreement in principle on the core elements of the bill. Not, of course, unanimous, every sentence and every comma. We are going through the legislative process. We have had stakeholders at the table, consumer privacy groups at the national level, at the state level, many industries in the technology sector and so many other sectors.
And Hannah joins us live now. So what are we worried about here? Is it just privacy in the vague sense, or has there been evidence of increases in identity theft or ransomware or what?
Well, and I think we've got a little bit of all of that across the board. But because there is some, I think there's a sense of, you know, we haven't kept up with the regulations. I think you heard Senator Carlisle say right there that, you know, Congress hasn't done enough to protect our consumer data and our privacy. And that, you know, not everybody likes the targeting ads. And we just don't have a sense of control over it ourselves. So they want to make sure that it's not getting away from us and that we can, at least in our state, have some sort of regulation, have some sort of control over that as far as that consumer data goes. But yeah, I think there is definitely, you know, we've got data breaches. There's all kinds of things that have happened in recent years and Congress has not acted.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've heard many warnings about what could happen, that we could turn into China where we're monitored because of our political views or religious views or our tendency to attend demonstrations. But I haven't seen much evidence of it. And as for the ads, I know they're annoying, but you can, I mean, I clicked on one yesterday and a Google page came out and said, how could we make this ad more appealing to you? Or why don't you like this ad? You know, I mean, they just seem to be very almost obsequious in their determination to make sure you love the ads. So, I mean, was there any particular threat that was cited in proposing these bills?
I think through the overall big boogeymen, you know, nothing specific that I had heard. You know, when we're talking about the facial recognition technology, though, there is a lot of things like that. Like you referenced China. Yeah. There are a lot of rules in this bill specific to surveillance, to what law enforcement can do, to the requirements if you're going to get a warrant, the annual reporting. You have to go before the judge if you're going to do a continual surveillance and things like that. Yeah. There are, you know, a lot of concerns when it comes to facial recognition technology. It's everywhere. It is all over. It's, you know, it can be traffic cameras, anything like that. There's always a lot of discussion on whether that's going to be violating somebody's rights, what law enforcement can do with that, and then where else it can go. There's a camera everywhere you go. Anyone could try to hack into that, try to get to you. So I think there's just a need for some protections is part of this discussion that they're having.
All right, it's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Very good. Very good.
I thought you'd like that.
I do love it.
It is now time for the Daily Dose of Kindness.
Absolutely, it is. We need a little theme music for that. Your Daily Dose of Kindness is sponsored by Mike Novak. Enlist with Novak.com, by the way. Appreciate that. It's an update to a story from last summer about a boy stuck in his home staring out a window at the world outside. As CBS's Steve Hartman tells us, things have changed.
Aside from immediate family, no one was allowed in the house to see 3-year-old Quinn Waters of Weymouth, Massachusetts. And more importantly, Quinn wasn't allowed out.
We basically keep him in a bubble just as a precaution.
Even a cold, a common cold, could be something that will bring him back into the hospital.
Parents Jarlath and Tara say Quinn's natural immunity was temporarily wiped out after he got a stem cell transplant to treat his brain cancer.
We are Italian.
Fortunately, the kid is a fighter. And as we first reported a few months ago, he kept a mostly positive attitude.
Do you want a drink or anything, dude?
No, thank you.
But it still stunk.
He sees all of this happening and he knows he's stuck inside. And there would be days.
Days when Quinn was literally pounding to get out.
Unfortunately, staring out a window is a poor substitute for walking out a door. Quinn's connection to the outside world has been limited to whoever passes by, which hasn't been all that limiting, actually.
It started off with family members, like, come to the window.
Then the neighbors started showing up to entertain. The police caught wind. And pretty soon, top-notch performers were just showing up on Quinn's front lawn.
It's turned into like a vaudeville stage out there.
Yeah, the window kind of became his window to the world, yeah. You know?
It got so you never knew what might happen by. One minute it could be a dog parade.
Look at that dog!
The next, a team of Irish step dancers. Everyone brought together by word of mouth and a will to help Quinn get better. Which his parents say did start happening.
It's the positive energy from all these people that we believe has gotten him through his sickness, you know. You can never repay, you know. Just maybe pay it forward, you know.
Being indebted, never felt so fortunate.
Come on without, come on within. You'll not see nothing like the mighty Quinn.
After this story first aired in August,
Things got even better for Quinn.
What are you doing?
Light years better.
Trick-or-treating?
By Halloween, doctors had released him from home confinement. And free to be a kid again, he rushed outdoors at warp speed.
You can't outrun your shadow, buddy.
He also got to drop the puck at a Boston Bruins game, felt the sand between his toes at the Massachusetts shore, and saw the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade pass by. There is no greater curse than cancer, but no greater blessing than beating it.
Oh, he always comes up with such great stories.
I know.
Time for the Sports Insider. And here she is, Stacey Ross from Tom, Jake, and Stacey, 710 ESPN. So I hear the Houston Astros have been stealing signs, and that means the manager and the GM get suspended by Major League Baseball and fired by the team. Has there ever been a penalty quite that severe for stealing signs before?
Not that I can think of, but again, sign stealing itself isn't completely illegal. It's using technology to do it. And then you have to think of the context. They use technology to steal signs through the regular season and playoffs in a year in which they won the World Series.
Yeah. Now, does that put an asterisk near the World Series? I mean, would the Astros have won had they not been using technology to steal signs, but just stealing them the old-fashioned way?
See, this is what makes cheating in itself just one of those things where you think, why even do it? Because the Astros had a great roster in 2017, and they could have probably gotten to the World Series and won it, depending. It's hard to take out the cheating and separate that from their performance. You have to always think, like, well, would they have gotten there? Would the Dodgers have won? Would there have been another team that went further? And so it's tough, right? And if you're the Dodgers, you're really upset. If you're a fan of a team where a pitcher got completely blown up by this team playing on the road against the Astros, you're really upset because you're wondering, you know, these people carried these bad games into their, you know, careers now or into their free agency, you know, now. And who knows whether or not that was impacted by sign stealing.
Let's talk a little bit about the new head coach for the Cougs. He comes from Hawaii, and he's arriving in the middle of a snowstorm. This doesn't seem like a good deal for him.
No, not really. But it's like, hey, welcome to Pullman. Welcome to Washington State.
Yeah.
But I think he's a great fit. He was one of the names thrown around, probably the second most popular name out there behind Grinch, Alex Grinch. And he has done really well in Hawaii. He didn't make it like a top program in the country, but that's really hard to do. But Brent Secker, our editor for 710 Sports, has kind of a primer on him. If anyone's interested in learning more, Hawaii had a combined record of 11 wins before he got there over, I think, the 3 years preceding his arrival.
And there's a new champion of college football, LSU, big comeback, apparently a fantastic victory. I didn't see the game. But what I saw was what happened after the game, where Odell Beckham Jr., who I guess plays for the Browns but was an LSU grad, showed up on the field with wads of cash and just began handing it out to the team. Can you do that?
Why not? I mean, why not? No. You can't, but I'm okay with it. I'm okay with this celebration. There was also a clip someone got of LSU quarterback Joe Burrow walking out of the locker room with a cigar. It's like, you know what? You guys just celebrate. Are you guys familiar with Ed Orgeron?
No.
Oh, my God.
Don't worry, I am.
What a funny question.
Thank you, Sully. No, he's Sully, do you want to explain? He's the LSU head coach.
Hey, he sounds like this out there.
Lovable coach. That's how he talks.
Oh, yeah. LSU, the great champion of the world. I love all our fans down Baton Rouge.
Yeah, I love Ed Orgeron. It's awesome.
He's so wonderful. He's been at USC before, so he's been at the Pac-12, but he's been at a couple different places. I think LSU was a favorite in part because people just love this coach.
Okay, but you're allowed to, I guess with the NCAA about to change their rules, this is pretty much a metaphor for what will be happening, at least for certain players. They'll be getting wads of cash for playing college football.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which okay. I'm fine with.
Okay. Stacey Ross, our Sports Insider. Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks, guys.
To Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post, David Farenthold. David, there's a Democratic debate tonight. We're down to six, except Michael Bloomberg is not going to be there. he's dumped something like $100 million in his campaign. I see his spots everywhere. He's starting to get some significant poll results. Is he going to be at any of these debates?
He's not going to be at this one. I think, you know, because they're often driven by both donations, which Bloomberg isn't really taking, and by poll numbers, which Bloomberg isn't. He has not really done very much in the polls yet because he just sort of got in. Also, this debate is really focused on Iowa, and Bloomberg has said he's not going to contest the first four states, Iowa, yeah, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. So, yes, I think as it goes on, we may see Bloomberg in these debates. But, you know, he's probably fine with this. His Bloomberg's whole shtick is that the rest of the Democrats are losers, and he's happy to let them fight it out, and then he's going to come in at the end once they've sort of taken each other out.
How does that work exactly? Why would the party agree to that? Would delegates really just ditch everybody who's been in it for, what, over a year now and put a billionaire in place when the Democrats are all about income inequality?
It's a great question. We don't know. I mean, and I should say right now, the polls that include Bloomberg still have him at like 5%. I mean, he's not taking the country by storm yet. But his idea is that he'll get delegates. He just won't get them from these first four states. I mean, you have to remember, you know, we've put so much emphasis on Iowa and New Hampshire, especially Iowa. But the actual result of someone winning that caucus is to get 11 delegates out of the hundreds you need. So I think Bloomberg has decided that people are wasting too much time there. He's going to put his time into places where nobody's advertising. You know, big states, Ohio, yeah, Texas, Super Tuesday states, and then he'll, once everybody's exhausted themselves in Iowa, he'll sweep in and start winning states then.
Okay, so it's safe to say there is really no consensus candidate among the Democrats. There's no Hillary Clinton out there right now. So,
I mean, for better or worse,
for
right?
For better or worse,
Hillary
right.
was a consistent, yeah, she couldn't win, though, yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, she won the popular vote, okay? But in any case,
true.
So the Democrats then... Is it fair to say that a lot is riding on this whole impeachment thing? Because if they can come up with some magical witness who starts turning even Trump supporters sour on Trump, that would be key for them, wouldn't it?
It would. I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, you know, who knows? I don't think we're ever going to see the Republican Senate vote to remove Donald Trump. But certainly it could damage him. A trial that has witnesses, that rehashes all the things that he did, could certainly damage him.
Now, the other thing I heard, and this is a report from CBS, they're talking to voters in Wisconsin, a swing state, and they're talking to the head of the local NAACP, and he was saying, you guys are campaigning on, you're basically campaigning against Trump. You're not really campaigning for anything. Well, you know, mm-hmm. we see Trump all around us every time we try to get a loan, every time he gets stopped by a cop. You got to give us something that says you can do better than that. I mean, have the Democrats risen to that challenge, and have they taken the black vote for granted?
Well, I think they have. Most of them have not risen to that challenge. I mean, the Biden pitch and the Bernie pitch, and to a certain degree, the Pete Buttigieg pitch is Trump is terrible. The country's in pretty good shape. Get rid of Trump, and the country will really thrive. But the advantage that Bernie Sanders has, and Elizabeth Warren to a degree, is that they meet that concern that you're just talking about. You know, the country is not all right. The country needs, you know, a real change. Bernie and Warren are really the only two who are running on that kind of platform.
Yeah. Now, for you, you've been hammering away at the president's finances. You are relentless. And you've been looking into his companies. Now, I know that you've mentioned before that the winning the presidency actually has hurt his companies. Is that still the case?
We don't see the full picture, but what we can see at individual properties is, yes, I mean, it's not winning as much as campaigning and being himself on a national stage has hurt a lot of his properties. They were in places where his main customer are people who don't like him now, rich people who live in cities. But one thing we haven't really understood and we're trying to understand this year is how much is he getting from the U.S. government? How much is the U.S. government paying Donald Trump to be president? Meaning, you know, the security and the staff that follow him to his properties, how much money does he make off them? I haven't really been able to answer that, and I hope I can this year.
Now, does he make? Why would he make money off them? It's always been costly to protect the president when he travels around, hasn't it?
That's right. So he often goes to his own places, the Trump Hotel, to Mar-a-Lago, to Bedminster, to other places. And what we've seen from the little bit of data we've gotten out of the Secret Service is that when he goes, Secret Service comes with him, and he charges them for stuff. And I can't quite tell what he's charging them for, but I think it's rooms in his hotels, food, some other sort of rentals. I think he's charging them a lot to be there protecting him. But the data we have is so spotty that it's hard to tell how much money that is. I'm trying to figure that out now.
Well, I mean, when the Secret Service protects any president, they obviously would pay for the hotel rooms that they occupy, don't they?
That's right. We've never had a position where the president could be the one renting them that hotel room.
Well, officially, it's his son, right? I mean, he's not actively running the company, is he?
True, but he still owns it. The only situation we've had sort of parallel is Joe Biden, who rented the Secret Service needed a cottage near his house in Delaware. Mm-hmm. Biden rented it to them for, I think, $2,200 a month. It's sort of the first time anybody had ever done that. Trump has taken that on a much bigger scale, though. The Secret Service paid Trump like $250,000 just in the first 6 months of his presidency.
Yeah. Okay, you're very good at settling arguments here. So based on what you know, who's playing more golf, Trump or Obama?
If you're comparing presidencies, Obama's probably playing a lot of golf now. But if you're talking about presidential golf.
Not now, as president. He's playing presidential golf.
Trump's golf is much, much greater than Obama's. I mean, really? The scale is like double already.
Double already. Because he promised, as I recall, to barely leave the White House.
You'll never see me on the golf course. You'll never see my properties. Yeah, that all went out the window.
Actually, now that I come to think of it, was that the way it was worded? You'll never see me on the golf course? Because that could be true.
I personally have never seen him on the golf course. It's true. Many people have, though.
Yeah. Okay. So just in case a lot is riding on this at a family discussion, is there an official web page where people can get a definitive readout of how much golf he's played and what it costs?
I prefer TrumpGolfCount.com. I think they do a really good job.
TrumpGolfCount.com. Got it. Is that a Washington Post property? I want to make sure there's no conflict.
No, it's an independent property, but I think their numbers are really good.
Okay, very good. David Farenthold live from the Washington Post. Thank you, David.
Thank you. You can ring
my bell, Rachel Bell. Seattle's Morning News, and now it is time for Rachel Bell to tell us the story of her 40th birthday. You're only 40?
Only 40. I know. To many people, I look 65. Can you believe that I'm only 40?
I was going to say 65, but yeah. So you're Gen X, right?
You know, I'm in that weird little mixed up zone, I guess, between Gen X and being a millennial. I don't think I'm a millennial, but I just turned 40. There's like a couple years that are confusing.
Pick. Just decide what you are.
Well, for today's story, I'm going to be a Gen Xer.
Okay, good. Because I hear the Gen Xers, when they go through their 40-year-old midlife crisis, are not doing the same things that we boomers did during our 40-year-old midlife crisis.
Yeah. So there's an article in the Wall Street Journal entitled "The Virtuous Midlife Crisis. Forget the sports car and the new trophy spouse. For Generation X, it's yoga, meditation retreats, and keto diets." And so I can relate to this because I read the headline and I said, oh no, I'm a cliche. I turned 40 a week ago, and this last weekend I went to California and I met up with a bunch of friends and we went out to the Channel Islands and we went hiking and we did a yoga class and we ate what I've been jokingly calling white lady yoga food. And I thought, oh, I guess other people are doing this too.
Sounds out of control, Rachel.
Wild. We did have some beer and wine, so it was a little crazy. But in this article was saying, you know, what we always think of as the classic cliche midlife crisis that the boomers did, you know, getting a sports car, leaving your wife for a younger woman. Apparently, this newer generation tends to celebrate becoming 40 or 50 by doing something very healthy. And there are practical reasons for this, which are, you know, we know a lot more about health now. And I think people are going, whoa, like I need to get healthy in the second part of my life. But, you know, one woman joked, she's like, how am I supposed to get a sports car? I have two children. Where are they going to sit in it? I logistically can't leave my husband because I can't do this by myself. But they're saying, so this generation got married later, had children later. So they basically want to be healthy to make sure that they see their kids graduate from high school.
Makes sense.
And, you know, they said in this article, they said there's always going to be people of every generation who do the wild birthday and, you know, that old cliche midlife crisis. It's not like everybody is doing this wellness thing. And even back in the day, you know, you guys were the hippie generation. You were doing meditation and wellness before we were. But they said the numbers are higher now. Like a lot more people are spending money to go on like a hiking tour through Portugal or like a bike tour or like what I did doing this yoga trip.
So did you do it you have always seemed very healthy to me anyway. So.
Yeah, this to me wasn't like, I'm turning 40, I got to get my life together. It was just things that I like to do. I like hiking and I do yoga. So it definitely wasn't, you know, I'm trying to make a change. So that's what I wonder is, are people having these, quote, crises? Or is it just that a lot of people tend to live these lifestyles, so of course they want to do those things on their birthday because it's what they like.
They're just using their birthday as an excuse to do what they would have done anyway.
Yeah.
Did you feel any different when you turned 40?
Not really. I mean, it's kind of, when people do, I'm always surprised. It's like, you're 39 yesterday, you're 40 today. What could have possibly changed?
Nothing.
But I do use birthdays as kind of like a touchstone for being grateful for things in my life. Uh-huh. A lot of people don't care about their birthday, don't celebrate their birthday. I always have something like a big party, and I always, always, always feel so much love, honestly. And people always tend to say really nice things and, you know, get you little gifts. And so I had a birthday party, and then I had this trip, and I cried at both of them because I really did feel really special. And you know, you kind of go through life. It's like, oh, you have your friends and you're busy and you're just running. But it felt very slowed down this year and maybe every year. And I thought, well, I really should pay attention to the people in my life and how great they are.
That's very good. That's very healthy. My generation had the unhealthy habit of always giving dark gifts on the 40th birthday, right?
You
know,
so
like
dumb.
A cane or, you know,
over the hill,
an AARP card. Yeah, right. Which is, I think, a very tired way to celebrate it.
What did you do for your 40th birthday?
We had the black balloons. And now when I look back at my 40th birthday, which was 27 years ago, it seems I was like a teenager then.
Yeah, I've been talking about that a lot with friends of how silly the marketing was back then. Because it was the same for my mom. Over the hill, the haunted house, paper plates in the back. It's like, we are so young. What are you talking about? It's not like it's the 1700s when you're going to die from the plague at 36.
What are you going to do when you're 65? Does 65 seem old to you now?
Of course.
Does it really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's,
I mean,
like,
40 used to seem old to me until I got there.
Yeah, I think it's like a different kind of old, though, because, you know, no offense, but you're in the last third, so? Right?
Are you sure?
I don't. Who knows? Maybe there'll be medical technology. You'll be living to 700 years old.
They have some amazing pharmaceuticals now.
Yeah. But also, what am I doing here in the snow? It was so sunny all week in California. Have you guys heard of California?
Yes.
What are we doing here?
Yes, we have.
I saw 100 dolphins.
Happy birthday, by the way.
Thank you so much, Dave Ross. Happy 27th anniversary of your 40th.